You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Camille Pagan.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank some sponsors for making the show possible. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, her new short story, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2, a sequel to A Superhero's Duty. Daniel Spires reveals to his team and Icarus that someone has been mass abducting the children of modern heroes and villains around the world. Icarus searches for answers while dealing with the physical aftermath of his encounter with Hellstorm. His powers are fading, and a compromised hero may cost him his life. This is an excellent new series from Patricia Gillum. There's going to be more coming soon. Stay tuned for it. Get in on the series while it's unfolding. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2. I'd also like to thank Richard Fox and his Ember War Saga. Guys, if you love science fiction the way I do, you must read the Ember War Saga. 9 books with several spinoffs, lots of great stuff going on in the Ember War. This one, and if you love audio, let me tell you, Luke Daniels narrates the audio for this series, and it is absolutely amazing. We're going to be talking about the Ember War Saga more in coming episodes, but go check it out on Amazon, The Ember War Saga by Richard Fox. Now on to our great show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the story and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Camille Pagan back on the show with us. She was on just about a year ago talking about her new book, Woman Last Seen in Her 30s. That book was a resounding success, found a huge audience, and she's back today to talk about her new book, I'm Fine and Neither Are You, which is a hilarious look at modern life. I'm excited to talk about it. Welcome back, Camille.
Thank you, Hank. So happy to be chatting with you.
So what's been going on this last year? Woman Last Seen in Her 30s was just coming out when we talked last. Mm-hmm. How was the book received, and what's your year been like since?
Well, so the book was received well, as far as I could tell. I think we chatted last time about how every time I read a book, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
I think, oh, who is going to read this? And then every time I'm reminded of why I write, because someone will email me and say, I really needed to read this at this time. And Woman Last Seen in Her 30s was a book about a woman in her 50s who's going through a pretty tough divorce. And I heard from so many women going through divorces who said, this really helped me through this journey. And thank you. And I wasn't thinking about that when I wrote it, but it was a lovely surprise.
That's awesome. That feeling of inadequacy and of the starting over of the project. I was talking with David Baldacci a couple of weeks ago, and I think he's found a little bit of success. God love him. I think he's finding his place in the writer community. Mm-hmm. Firmly in cheek. He talked about that as well. That every time you sit down to start that new book, that chapter one is the great leveler of the playing field. Everybody starts back from scratch every time, and that is not a feeling unique to you or to any other writer out there, that starting a new project is scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear that some of these mega successful authors feel this way, even after 10, 20, 30 books. I think that writing is just such a revealing, vulnerable craft, even if you are sort of writing the same book every time. A lot of us stay on a couple topics. For me, I mostly write about love and loss, even though each story is different. And yet every time you'd think it was my first novel. I'm just, what am I doing? How am I going to do this? And then you get into it and suddenly nothing else matters. You just want to stay with your story.
Right, Right. I'm finding neither of you is what number book for you? Which how many novels does this make now?
This is my fifth novel, and it was a story that I was writing another book. I was working on a book, and it wasn't really going anywhere. And I had one of these insane days as a mother and a wife and a person who works full time. And it was just, you know, everything that could go wrong went wrong. And I sat down at my desk and started writing. And the result was, in a single day, the first two chapters of this book. Because I was just thinking about how much pressure, this is not unique to mothers at this point in time, how much pressure family life is right now for working parents. And how I think that society really wants us to show that everything is great. And certainly social media makes that more so. You know, people put up their filtered photos and they don't post about the hard times most of the time because they think that other people don't want to hear it. But the truth is we're all struggling a little bit. And this story really reflects that.
Is that a normal process for you when a story begins, that it just kind of flows out of maybe a feeling or an emotion, or is that how it normally gets started for you?
Every book. And it's funny because I'll try to start another book that I think sounds like a good idea. I have no shortage of ideas. I'm always thinking, oh, that would make a good story. That would make a good story. And I'll sit down and, you know, write a couple chapters and think, oh, the writing's not bad. But if it doesn't have that emotional connection for me, I soon abandon it and find something else to work on. So I do have several false starts tucked into my desk drawer, so to speak. And yeah, I need to have that emotional connection, that feeling of, oh, I have to write this right now.
It's so funny. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, the old cliche question is where you get your ideas from. And the reality is ideas are everywhere, and nobody ever has a shortage of ideas. But there's something different about that inspired idea, that one idea that either floats to the top above all the others or grabs you emotionally. When you sit down to start writing and you think that the story is going to be this other thing, but then this just starts flowing out. How long does it take for you to know that this is the idea?
Around 10,000 words for me. Most of my drafts come in around 80 to 85,000. And at the 10,000 word mark, I know if I want to stay with it or not. And most of the time I do, just for the reason that we discussed. But once in a while I think, well, I'm just not enthusiastic about this. I'm not going to keep going. So, yeah.
Have you ever gone back to one of those, 10,000 word or less ideas that didn't make the cut? Have you ever gone back and one of those all of a sudden became relevant again, or maybe you knew where the story was going? Have you ever gone back to one and it found new life?
Well, I'm fine, and neither are you, is actually one of those stories. I had been working on this draft of a couple who gives each other a list of things they want the other person to change in an attempt to fix their marriage. But they were very different characters, and the event that kind of triggered it was very different too. So the story didn't have that emotional resonance, and I set it aside for almost a year. And that book even had a different title and everything. And the concept stayed with me, but I thought, well, you know, if it's meant to be, I'll figure something out. And then after this crazy day that I told you about, that's when I was like, this is the right idea, but I need to execute it completely differently. And I think the end result was much better.
When at what point do the characters come to you? When you start to sit down and kind of write through these emotional feelings, when you've had this day, does a character just pop up and say, okay, I'm the one you're going to write about? How do you begin with the setting with a character? How does it start unfolding for you?
Character is story for me. I find that without particularly my protagonist, but then the world of that protagonist, the people in that world, I have no story. And I think that's why I struggled with the earlier draft, because the two people, the married couple that I had envisioned, they were pale and not fleshed out. They just were not right. And then the protagonist of the draft that is now I'm Fine and Neither Are You, Penny, she just came to me very clearly. And she's not like me at all, which is funny because everyone always thinks you're your main character. Even though all of my main characters have been so different, people say, oh, that's you, right? No, no, it's not. Penny's a little bit unlikable, I think, on the page initially because she's looking at the difficulty of her life. And what I find is really a challenge for me as a novelist is to keep being honest because I write these very interior novels where people, they admit the truth rather than giving you the glossy side. That's the whole book. And so with this one in particular, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm really exposing some hard thoughts that some people are not going to want to read. And I did it anyway. And she comes around and she learns to see that she's played a role in her own troubles in her marriage, in her career, that she is culpable, but also human, and that that's okay, if right. that makes any sense.
Sure, sure. I find it really interesting that you begin with a character that's not exactly likable. You know, and the you know, if you've read a lot of writing craft books, you probably come across the Save the Cat, you know, books and all that. And one of the things that they tell you is that if you have a character that's unlikable, in the beginning of the script or the book, as it's been translated to novel writing, you know, let them do something heroic in the beginning, like save the cat. And then we immediately like this character, all, you know, besides her foibles and whatever. Mm-hmm. But you choose a different tact. And I love that you do. What's that?
I'd argue that, you know, Penny's active, her heroic act is getting through her morning as a mother.
Right, so right.
It's funny because the couple people who've said to me, oh, I didn't relate to this one as much. They tended to be single men. No mom I've handed this story to has said, oh, I didn't get it. Right. So there's that part of it, but no, she doesn't do anything, you know, she doesn't swoop down and save a dying bird or, you know, rescue her neighbor who's fallen and can't get up. None of that.
But what I love that you do, mm-hmm. Is that you have this way in all of your books of threading in this kind of wry humor and this almost dark humor sometimes that allows us to see all of the bad and stuff, but find some, you know, almost wicked sense of humor in it, which, you know, if you've raised kids, and my wife and I have 5 kids, and they're almost all grown.
God bless.
Yeah, you learn to have some real gallows humor in parenting pretty quickly. And I love that you do that. And by doing that, you take this character that is not, you know, just immediately heroic and all this, and you make me really sympathize with her and to be able to walk alongside her in that. And it's really a brilliant tact that you take.
Thank you. It's funny because I don't think of myself as a particularly funny person. I think that a lot of times the way I write is just the real interior monologue that a lot of us have. And I didn't know that at first, of course, because I didn't know what other people are thinking. It's really been over the course of many books where readers just consistently say, well, that's actually how I think. And I think, oh, thank God. It's not just me. Like, okay. So, yeah, there's that to it. It's not intentional. And that's why my stories are not, some of them are funnier than others. Like Life and Other Near-Death Experiences is a really, really funny, sharp book because that was who the character was. It wasn't intentional. And then the next one was a much more serious, unexpected love story. So it was wry, but it lacked that kind of direct humor.
Yeah. You deal, you know, the core of the book is this idea of honesty. Mm-hmm. And we all say honesty is the best policy, and we teach our children that. But you really play with the idea of is it worth it? Mm-hmm. What made you come to this this kind of underpinning idea of the book and to explore what honesty really means and do we really want honesty? And how did you kind of come to that?
Well, I would always describe myself as someone who's a terrible liar and a fairly honest person. And that's true. I am pretty bad at lying. It gives me a stomachache to even say, you know, anything that isn't true. But then a friend of mine, Judy Kettler, wrote this really neat essay about lying and giving up all lying. And I thought, how honest am I really? Because sometimes you do say things to spare another person's feelings, the little white lies. And each one seems pretty innocuous, but I think if you add them up, sometimes they can add up to something more. Not always, but sometimes. And then I thought, well, would I really want my husband to be completely honest with me? I don't know. And I'll never know how honest he is. And so that kind of led to this idea of the protagonist says, I want to be honest, you know, in my marriage and in my relationships with other people. But of course, that comes with consequences. And is it worth it?
And as you're writing the story, the other characters, how did they start coming in? And did you kind of see this story fully formed from the beginning? Or did Penny, as you got into her head, did the other characters just start kind of filling out the scene?
I knew that Penny would have a best friend who is very like her, but a glossy version of her. This is Jenny, who is a woman she met when she was a young mother. They both had babies that were fairly newborn, and they formed this very tight relationship. But Jenny seems to have everything. She has a husband who makes a lot of money and adores her. She's always talking about how she and her husband have this very active sex life. And things come easily to her. So she starts a blog about her life, and people turn to her for advice on how to be and what to do. And Penny, meanwhile, is making her way, but struggling a little more overtly, thinking all along that Jenny has it figured out. And then something happens, and she finds out that Jenny has been hiding something really devastating from her and has to reevaluate what her friend's life was, and then in turn, her own life.
When you start looking at secrets and the idea that a lot of times we are not exactly what we project to others that we are, those are things that hit us all, pretty hard, pretty deeply. Mm-hmm. Does this become, as you start telling the story and you start digging through secrets and things like that, how do you know where to pull back to not make Penny just a complete monster? How do you balance the kind of peeling the layers back to show more and more while keeping the audience engaged and on Penny's team?
Right. Well, I think that she's a good person at heart who maybe sees herself as a victim of her circumstances, and then comes to understand that she has a lot more control than she realizes. And I think that that is a really crucial part of adulthood, especially not so much in your 20s. Just looking around and the people in my life, I see that sometimes that comes a little later. Even though you've got everything else figured out, you don't realize that you have more control than you think you do. And so I wanted her to have that experience of waking up and seeing, okay, I'm playing a part in this. What can I do to make it better? Because there's so much you can't control, but there's a lot you can control too.
Right. As you wrote it, and as you know, kind of an outlet for that bad day that you had, how did it help you as the writer, but also as the person who's reading this book for the first time? I don't think we look at writing that way very often. Mm-hmm. But how did the writing of this book change you or help you in what you were dealing with?
Well, I always think of writing a book as a long meditation on a theme, and sometimes you don't even know what that theme is until you're done. So initially, I was just thinking about the way that women especially feel that they need to be perfect or show the best side of themselves to other people. And I think that that pressure comes from the outside, but also the inside. But it took me the whole draft to kind of work through my ideas about that. And just understanding the value of not being honest with every person, right? You run into someone in the grocery store, they don't actually want to know whatever, you know, what you've been telling your therapist, let's say. You know, they might want the brief update, but not the deep digging. But there are people close to you in your life who you can turn to and be honest with. And I think we could all do a better job of that.
Yeah. A story like this really allows you to look at some things going on in society, some things that we're all struggling with, some things that we as a culture, as a nation, as people are dealing with, and things are really brought to light. Mm-hmm. Were there specific things, big themes that you wanted to tackle, or issues that you wanted to address?
Well, so we talked a little about perfectionism and honesty and marriage, but this book, without even spoiling anything, it does touch on the opioid epidemic. And as you may know, I'm a health journalist. That's my other job. And so most of my books have some kind of health element to them. And this one, I sought out that angle, not so much as a journalist, but because I kept hearing about people, acquaintances or friends of friends or people within my circle who were really suffering from this epidemic, and some of whom were dying and no one even knew they had a problem. And I have written about it too as a journalist, and something that doctors say a lot is that people just don't understand the extent of the epidemic, and a lot of people who look fine are not. And so I just thought, well, that should go in my story. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it really has become an epidemic, and it's it's something bigger than you and I can change today.
Absolutely.
But I do think that people would be really surprised at the people in our communities that are suffering from this and dealing with this. It has really touched all facets of life. What can we do? I know we can tell stories like this. We can mm-hmm. we can kind of bring awareness that people really are suffering with this. Is there something that we can do to get involved to try to change that?
I think a lot of it is being a judgment-free person for the other people in your life, because what the one person struggling with this in my story was dealing with, and what I've heard from friends and acquaintances, et cetera, is that they were afraid to be judged. They didn't want to admit that they were dealing with something that they felt they should have been able to control. But this is what addiction is. You know, it's beyond your control. At some point, you have to get help in order to beat it most of the time. And so, you know, for me in my own life, I'm trying to listen more and be available and make sure that I'm not passing judgment on things I don't fully understand, if that makes sense, so that other people will feel comfortable saying, hey, I'm struggling, I need help. And maybe then I can give them resources.
It's a difficult thing to deal with people that we know that are struggling with things like that, and to be non-judgmental and to just be the friend, the person for them that we can. It's another thing altogether to be a writer who's telling a story like this and to not have an agenda. Because we all feel certain ways about things, and you know, as we write, these things come out. And I know for me, when I've dealt with things like that, I go back and, you know, first I put my thoughts in, and I go back and I edit. Okay, that doesn't sound right. That's not going to come across right. And you edit and you edit and you edit. What is your process like for that, to tell these stories, to get it out? And are you constantly honing what you say?
Yes, because I really want to make sure that there's no service journalism sneaking into my books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that is not the purpose of a novel. I try to come at it without an agenda and more just the idea of exploring themes. And then in those tricky sections, for example, there was the part of the book where the person dealing with the addiction comes clean about it in an unexpected way. And I had to really carefully craft that language so that it didn't sound preachy and that it was authentic. I hope I accomplished that. I'm not sure, but I'm always cognizant of trying to write my scenes and characters as naturally as possible.
Let's talk writing and publishing for just a minute. This is your fifth novel. Mm-hmm. How do you think your writing process has changed over five novels? I know you lead a very busy life. How do you make sure that novel writing keeps a prominent place in your life?
Well, I'm a first things first kind of person. I always remind myself, you start the day with writing and then it goes from there because the rest of the day can get away from you. I have become more efficient in a lot of ways as each book is published. So now, for example, with the last three books I've done, I write an extended synopsis first.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
No use crying over spilled milk. Eliza hated that cliche. She'd grown up a cliche. Her life a bowl of cherries, duck soup, easy as pie, child's play behind a white picket fence. Mother had been the Wyatt Earp of cliches, firing them off, quick draw. A rotten apple spoils the barrel. Smile and the world smiles with you. Every dog has his day. Children should be seen and not heard. She believed them all, particularly this last. Eliza obliged, preferring to wander the streets of Wytheville, Virginia, on her own lonesome terms. The divorce left Laura a spinster librarian, and one false step on icy stairs left her an invalid as well. The accident happened on New Year's Eve, 1950. Laura had just locked the doors of Wytheville Public Library. We must make black-eyed peas tomorrow, Laura had been thinking, with turnip greens. That ensured a lucky New Year, and if you swept some money over your threshold, a prosperous one, too. She loved those old Southern traditions. She looked both ways, checking for Negroes, but turned a heel on the icy marble of the stairs and fell into the bushes below, breaking the long bones in both legs. Eliza had taken advantage of her mother's absence. She'd lost her virginity that same night. She'd swept Ron Partridge over her threshold, initiating her own beloved tradition. She was nursing a hangover, giddily reliving the event, but around 8:30 she realized that her mother had not come down to breakfast. She checked her mother's bedroom, found it empty, took the bus down to the library, climbed the high stairs, knocked hard on the library doors, and heard a groan below. Laura lay under the William Penn barberry bushes, below the yellow-trimmed windows of the nonfiction section. Her white stockings ran Jezebel red with blood. Sweat and melted snow had soaked her blouse, and her gray forehead blazed. The broken bones didn't kill Laura Merrick. She lay in the hospital, wheezing, her legs mortared up in casts. She had few visitors after the first week. Her church group was glad to fret over a poor thing for a day or two, but they trickled away when Laura had the bad manners to linger. On Valentine's Day, as her mother slept, Eliza drew big, sloppy hearts on her casts. Laura harumphed when she woke and insisted on keeping her legs hidden beneath blankets afterwards. But in late March, something miraculous happened. Laura's self-control dropped. She ranted at nurses, spit at doctors, swore like a Navy pilot dropping F-bombs on Hiroshima. She had dementia, the doctors said. Eliza decided that her mother had just stopped believing her own bullshit. The spells continued over the next 2 weeks, and Eliza enjoyed her mother's company for the first time. They swapped bawdy jokes, ogled the handsome interns, and chattered like best girlfriends late into the evening. They had long conversations, and Laura spoke her own mind in her own words about things that mattered to her. It broke Eliza's heart when the prim, condescending librarian returned. Laura hardly acknowledged anything that had passed between them. the cliches returned. You can't have your cake and eat it too. A leopard doesn't change its spots. Nothing is certain except death and taxes. This last proved true. On April 15th, Laura Merrick marked her Bible with a tongue depressor, set it on her nightstand, leaned back against the headboard, and coughed blood down the front of her nightdress. Eliza found her that way, dead as the proverbial doornail, and yes, the blood was thicker than water, just as her mother had always said. Much thicker than water, in fact. Perhaps as thick as molasses in January.